of Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, rising water threatens a Leelanau Peninsula travel gem, Fishtown.
The water is just right up under the edge of those docks.
A years-long effort to improve mental health care delivery in Michigan postponed again.
Mental illness affects us all, whether directly or indirectly. If you don't feel safe sitting in a movie theater anymore, if you don't feel safe sitting in a restaurant, then mental illness affects you.
Closing Detroit's digital divide.
If you had to choose between internet or water, 11 times out of 10, you're going to choose, water.
Tree-threatening gypsy moths busy laying a bumper crop of eggs.
Telephone poles, they put it on vehicles, houses, concrete slabs, anywhere that they might be. So it won't just be on your trees.
Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, nearly half of Detroit households cannot afford to pay for pricey internet access, but the city's new director of digital inclusion plans to change that. We'll learn how later in the program. But first, one of Northern Michigan's travel gems is on the west shore of the Leelanau Peninsula. Fishtown, with its weathered fishing shanties and smokehouses. But this spring's a rough one. All the rain means rising water in the Great Lakes with a strong chance of record high levels this summer. Bad news for historic Fishtown. Amanda Holmes is with the Fishtown Preservation Society in Leland. Amanda, what's the flooding look like right now in Fishtown? Paint us a picture.
Well, flooding, I think when you think about flooding, you think it's kind of covering a wide, broad area across lowlands. What you see in Fishtown right now, if you were to go down, and I was actually just down there about an hour ago, you have the docks that a lot of people are familiar with. The water is just right up under the edge of those docks. And so, and that's just what it is at a normal state now, which is about 5-6 feet higher than we'd become accustomed to. And any shift of wind, additional rain, water over the Leland Dam, that can shift everything another 6 to 8 inches just quite quickly.
And what's it doing to these old wooden buildings?
Well, the shanties, we have one building that's from 1903. It's called the Morris Shanty. And actually right in there right now, there's about 4 inches of standing water. That building is a treasure. And it just went down to just to do another assessment to know that we need to get that building lifted and shifted as soon as possible in order to save it. Construction projects can't happen in Fishtown until the fall because there are all these amazing little businesses that are there that people also have come to love in addition to everything else they may love about Fishtown and fishing. Those buildings are, there are a lot of little families that depend on them, so we can't really do construction projects at that time. But we're hoping... we have some plans underway for replacing the docks, lifting and redoing the foundations on two of the shanties, a slightly larger project on the Carlson Fishery Building, water drainage off of West River Street, a whole infrastructure shift just to deal with water. These were plans we'd had in place, actually been working on them for the last 4 years. It happens that the water itself has beat us to it in where it's happening right now, but also gives us a chance to think about how high we're going to be putting these buildings.
And is there worry that this is going to affect tourism in Leland when you have like a big, wet year like this?
I quite honestly, I think a lot of people are curious and they're thinking, oh my gosh, I haven't seen Fishtown in a long time or I've never seen it before. In some odd way, seeing the force of water like this is an attraction. And water has been high there in the past. Every 30, 40 years, you have a cycle. But most people have never seen anything like it. I love to talk to some of the older fishermen. They're like, yeah, I remember way back when we had another issue. But it's never been this high this early. I think that's what has people extra worried. But also, I'm grateful that we have some plans that we're working on. We don't have all the money for those plans yet. So that is something that anyone out there who loves Fishtown and would like to be a part of making certain that we can have this project funded, that's a great way to express it. But tourism, this time of year, you start to kind of build up all the way through into early September, and I'm seeing larger numbers, actually, in people visiting. They're curious to know what's going on and a handful about what can they do to help.
And the big worry for you, then, is will these buildings be there in the future?
That's my job, to make certain that they are here in the future. And actually, it's been the job of anyone who's ever been a part of Fishtown. Fishermen looked after it before we did. There's a history of the community and caring for this place, and there's a lot that needs to be done. But that's our commitment, to make certain that it's here in the future as a commercial fishing destination. There's also a lot of angling here, and just people loving to come to a place that does not feel like anything you will experience anyplace else in Michigan.
Amanda Holmes, Fishtown Preservation Society. Amanda, thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
Who should be in charge of treating the some 300,000 Michigan residents who have serious chronic mental illness? That's the controversial question at the heart of a years-long effort to improve mental health care. At stake, who ultimately controls the state's nearly $2.6 billion Medicaid mental health system? Here's Kevin Fisher, executive director of the Michigan chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, speaking on Stateside in 2017.
There are a lot of concerns with oversight, with where the money ends up, with how we are or are not able to reinvest in the system if we take it from a public to a private system. Mm-hmm. And that has been our concern, and that's the concern of the people who utilize the services.
Private health plans argue they can deliver better mental health care at a lower cost than the public system. But state health officials announced last week pilot projects to test new models for delivering care will be delayed by another year to October 2020. NAMI's Kevin Fisher is back with us now. Kevin, there were three pilot programs expected to be working in six counties. Remind us, what was the purpose of these pilot programs?
It was to better integrate behavioral and other physical health care to make it more cost-effective, reduce stigma, and basically deliver better outcomes for people who live with mental health diagnosis in Michigan.
And DHHS sent a letter to legislative leaders earlier this month saying some progress has been made, but, quote, major outstanding questions remain. What major issues are still unresolved?
The one that I'm aware of is the finance structure is still an issue, and the issue of responsibilities and basically liability. Who is going to be responsible for what?
And so they are delaying the pilot projects until October 2020. So what does this latest setback and this overall inability to sort out these fundamental issues say to you?
That from the beginning, this process was not well thought out. It shows that there was no plan of execution in 2017. When the health plans presented to the legislature and the department back in 2016 that they could achieve these savings, at no time in the now 3.5 years that I've been involved in this process have we ever been told how they plan to achieve those savings, how they plan to deliver integrated care better than the public system could. And I think, again, in hindsight, going back 3 years, there was no plan then. And I don't think there's one now, which is why we continue to see these delays pushed out, because there was never a plan.
Kevin, this can get pretty wonky. Healthcare policy is complex. I don't need to tell you that. But boil it down for us. Why is this conversation about integrating physical and mental health care in Michigan so important? Why should people pay attention and care?
Well, and let me be clear. We as advocates, even the people who receive services in the state of Michigan, are not against integrated care. It is how we achieve it. Again, the health plans have a dismal at best record of providing service to people who live with mild to moderate mental health diagnosis. So the expectation that they could better deliver services for people who live with severe and persistent mental health diagnosis didn't make sense from the beginning, because they just don't have the breadth of knowledge, history, and expertise to deliver that. The people of Michigan should be really concerned about this and paying attention, because at the end of the day, mental illness affects us all, whether directly or indirectly. If you don't feel safe sitting in a movie theater anymore, if you don't feel safe sitting in a restaurant, then mental illness affects you. And this is a big part of our budget. And the fact is, we can and should deliver better outcomes, which benefits our entire state. It improves outcomes for the people who live with mental health diagnosis. People are able to live better quality of life. They're able to be employed. They have families. They have a sense of self-being and a sense of self-worth. That benefits us all.
There have been attempts in other states to let private health plans take more control over mental health care. How has that gone?
Not very well. There is a document out there called Lessons Learned from six states that attempted. In particular, Iowa and Kansas was a tremendous failure because privatizing is not always the solution. At the end of the day, when you privatize, you're diverting responsibility and finances to a for-profit organization who ultimately their desire is to make a profit. And we understand that. The problem with that as it relates to delivering behavioral health care is there is an upfront cost that we all have to accept for long-term benefit and gain. And the health plans are impatient and unwilling to wait to achieve those savings. And even if you achieve the savings in administrative costs in, let's say, the first or second year, then how do you continue to deliver profits to your shareholders? After a while, the only way you can do that is by cutting services, which is exactly what we do not need.
This process of designing what's called the Section 298 initiative to kind of design this pilot model, this is moving into its fourth year now. Where do things go from here, and what concerns you the most?
The continued delays concern me the most because, again, to continue to delay this further highlights the fact that there was no real plan to implement this from the beginning. If you remember, we spent about 18 months on a work group. It was referred to as the former Lieutenant Governor Calley 298 work group, where the legislature tasked us with making recommendations on how the system would move forward. To this day, we have never heard anyone explain why they didn't follow or at least look at the recommendations that were presented. They've never said, we reviewed them and this is why we're not going in that direction and we're going to move forward with the pilots, with the health plans. So again, I simply don't think there was good thought that went into this. I think there was political motivation for moving forward with privatization and not doing what's best, not only for the people who receive services, but for the citizens of Michigan as a whole, because we all will incur the cost.
Kevin Fisher, Executive Director of the Michigan Chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Kevin, thanks.
Thank you.
We offered the Michigan Association of Health Plans, which has been lobbying for the funding changes, an opportunity to join us. We have not heard back. After the break, what a boom in gypsy moths means for trees in Michigan. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, get ready, Michigan. It's going to be a big summer for gypsy moths. James Weifrich is a forest health specialist with the state DNR. Why should we be expecting a larger than usual number of invasive gypsy moths?
It's important to note that gypsy moth is a reoccurring pest that we get every so often in Michigan. This year, we're just having an outbreak get started over the last couple years because we've had three droughts in a row. And the reason these droughts are so significant is because when trees do not have the water they need, they can't fight off insect pests like gypsy moth. In addition, the drought itself is a key player for a fungus that usually controls gypsy moth outbreaks. And when it doesn't rain, the spores of that fungus actually aren't released.
So these poor trees are stressed. And I know gypsy moths, I was reading, they were first seen in Michigan back around 1954. But I remember the 80s and the early 90s, and gypsy moths ravaged trees around the state. Is there reason to worry that that could happen this year?
No. Back in the 80s and 90s, the fungus itself wasn't present in Michigan that controls these outbreaks. And a lot of the predators and parasites and even the virus couldn't do a good enough job to control these outbreaks. Since the 90s, we actually went around and released this fungus that's specific for gypsy moths. And now that the fungus is out there and has built up spore banks, we don't see the mass defoliation across the state like we used to in the 80s and 90s. Now we will see localized buildups and usually they'll collapse within a couple years instead of being prolonged defoliation events.
So that is the good news, and we can be grateful for that fungus. Are there areas where we're already seeing trees being defoliated by gypsy moths this year?
The calls haven't really started in yet, and our aerial survey doesn't usually start till the end of June and into July when we actually get up and fly around looking for defoliation. But there are multiple areas that we noted last year that we think will have heavier defoliation this year.
And what would those be?
Those areas would be in Ionia County, Berry County, and Washtenaw County.
What are the best things we can do to protect our trees from the moths?
So there's a few things that you can do to prevent outbreaks from occurring. Good tree health, making sure that your trees are watered and have plenty of nutrients, helps those trees fight off gypsy moth infestations. You can also put up tree vans around the tree if you notice that there are gypsy moth in your area. Those usually help contain some of the caterpillars. And then there's always going out and scraping off egg masses off from tree trunks or anything that the gypsy moth will lay its eggs on.
What do they look like?
The egg masses are usually about a quarter size-ish size, and they're a brownish tan color.
And do it gently. You don't want to hurt the bark, right?
Yeah, you can scrape it off. The bark will take some the pressure off, but they lay it on telephone poles. They put it on vehicles, houses, concrete slabs, anywhere that they might be. So it won't just be on your trees.
And then as far as just overall controlling the population, if we have another summer of drought, hopefully we won't, but we could. Are there other steps besides that fungus to help control the population?
Yeah, there's always the possibility that you can have an aerial spray or buy some insecticide yourself to spray smaller trees. You just want to make sure that you look for the BTK ingredient, which is very specific to gypsy moth in particular. It is not harmful to pets or children, so you don't have to worry about them coming into contact with the spray. And we usually only recommend people do it if they have outbreaks in residential areas where people are dealing with the nuisance of gypsy moths, where the gypsy moths are raining frass out of the canopy on them. They're running across their driveway, and when they're killed, they actually can stain the concrete in areas and make them slick, as well as getting into people's cars, getting into people's houses. So it's kind of a damper on people's life.
Yeah, I think you just grossed everybody out, James. Well, we got good advice to deal with this boom in gypsy moths in Michigan for the summer. Thank you so much, James Weaveridge, who's a forest health specialist with the Michigan DNR. Thank you so much.
No problem.
For years now, analytics have dominated baseball. The book and movie Moneyball portray the early changes in the sport.
The problem we're trying to solve is that there are rich teams and there are poor teams. Then there's 50 feet of crap. And then there's us. It's an unfair game.
Researchers at the University of Michigan have gotten into the analytics game with a partnership with the Detroit Tigers. So how is their work changing what fans are seeing on the field from their beloved hometown team? Jay Sartori is Senior Director of Baseball Analytics and Operations for the Detroit Tigers. Jay, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Cynthia.
And we have Stephen Kane here. He's an assistant research scientist in mechanical engineering for the University of Michigan. Stephen, hello.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You know, Jay, I'm sure that Mayo Smith and his 1968 World Series champion Tigers would be left wondering, what the heck is baseball analytics? So if you were describing it to Norm Cash, how would you describe baseball analytics to him?
I think the best way to explain analytics and what it's doing in baseball is no different than what's being done in many other industries is nowadays, since there's such readily accessible information and data to people much more than in the past, that we, you know, we take that information and we organize it, and then we study it in order to basically help our decision-making process or our player development process in the example of baseball. And then part of what we're doing with Michigan is more player development.
What are the goals of baseball analytics? Like, what are you getting, and what's the purpose?
I would say the purpose is really to harness the amount of information that we have at our fingertips to help our decision-making process. So throughout the history of baseball, you know, front offices have had to make decisions on player acquisitions or how to train their players. And now we're armed with so much more data that can be looked at by, you know, extremely smart people to help inform those decisions, that we're trying to basically do it the best that we can with all of the information that we have.
So, Stephen, what kind of information do you and U of M's team deliver to guys like Jay?
Yeah, so what we're currently bringing is measurements of, you know, human movement, I guess, is what my specialty is, and understanding biomechanics of human movement. So in terms of, you know, the traditionally available data, which might be your, you know, baseball performance type data that, you know, Jay is saying has been available for years, we're getting more kind of fine scale data where you might get to take a look at how someone is swinging their bat, how they're pitching, you know, the exact type of movements they might be moving with. So how does that relate to their performance? So really a measurement of, you know, biomechanics, how the individual players are moving. So instead,
so how do you do this? Give me a for, let's say you've got a slugger. Do you go down? Do you video? How do you do this?
Yeah, so the types of tools we're using, you know, a lot of these tools have been used in biomechanics labs for a while. So video is very common, and obviously lots of people in the baseball world are already using video to analyze performance. Force platforms, which measure basically the force that the ground is pushing on your feet when you're jumping, when you're swinging a bat. And then my area of expertise is with inertial sensors, which you can attach to different places on the body. It measures acceleration and angular velocity. And from that, you can, you know, you can almost get something like a motion capture system. If you've watched movies that use CGI animation, you might have seen clips of a person wearing reflective markers in some special lab. Well, with this inertial sensor technology, we can get similar types of things, but you don't need to be in a lab. You can be on the baseball field. So we're working to utilize these tools to create kind of measurements of player movement, which then could be linked up to how they're actually performing.
So, Jay, you get this data from Stephen. Give me a concrete example. Help me understand, let's say, for a hitter, what would you do then with that information? What are you looking for, and how can you use that to help your player?
Well, the information is fairly new to us. We've been, you know, in this working together for just a few years now. So essentially, while we won't really go into like full details on the information that, you know, and how we best use it, just
proprietary
for
secrets,
proprietary reasons and competitive advantages.
Sure.
But essentially, the information that we garner out of that, we want to use to help inform the player, inform the coaches, so they can improve their performance. If there is something that we find that is worthwhile and noteworthy that could transfer to the coach and to the player to improve his performance, then that follows that pattern of communication and with the goal of improving that player's performance on the field.
I'm interested in how the players receive this information. If you study all this data and you see something that needs to be worked on, are the players open to you coming and going, you know what we saw from the study U of M did, and you need to work on this or stop doing that? Are they open to that?
I mean, generally speaking, you know, there's various types of personalities. There are types of players who really love this information, and that's the way that their mind works, and that's a good communication tool to help them understand some of the concepts you'd be transferring to them, like via the coaching process. There are other players who are less into that type of information, and they're more about the feel of how their performance is. And so our goal is to basically use this information where it helps and can inform a player to help him make a change. But if they're not wholly on board with it, it's not something that we would force on them, but we would try to explain how this could be a tool to help them.
You know, speaking of feel, there are some who feel that analytics has taken some of that feel, that traditional, you know, gut instinct of how to work with a player out of the game. What do you think about that?
I still think that exists. I don't think that analytics can quantify everything. I think analytics tries to quantify as much as it can, but there are certainly other aspects of coaching or of player analysis that, you know, are very difficult to quantify or are quite honestly not able to be quantified at all. And I would say eschewing those and saying that there's no merit to that type of analysis is wrong. And so we try and blend the two together to make our best decisions.
How does this help you as you're scouting new prospects? Do you use analytics in that process as well as is working with players that are on the roster now?
Certainly, yeah. Our analytics department extends to all aspects of baseball operations, from, you know, amateur scouting all the way up through our major league. So we feel that we can use this information to help all of the staff throughout our organization, you know, be better. Any type of information that we can get our hands on and try to, you know, draw conclusions from that are helpful, we will certainly do that.
Stephen, what have you learned through this process of working with the Tigers? What light has been shed for you on what it takes to play this game and to succeed in this game?
Yeah, so I guess the first time I went down to Lakeland, the thing to me that really struck me was just how many people are involved in a baseball team and really the pipeline of developing talent, finding talent. I mean, you know, you've got a small company here. You know, it's not just the guys that you watch on TV or listen to on the radio. So, you know, there's a lot of important decisions being made at all different steps along the process. So having more information to help those decisions, I think, is, you know, like Jay said, is critical. I'm going to go back to, you know, you talked about the players. You know, the younger players seemed, you know, when we were down there doing some testing, seemed to be very into the new technology. And, you know, I think because they're very interested in what they might be able to gain from that.
Do you watch the game differently now?
Yeah, I mean, for a couple reasons. One, you know, I've worked, you know, I'm a little more invested, you know, because we're working with some of these guys. But also in terms of watching the movements and, you know, I'm thinking about how different players look, looking at some of the differences in, you know, the swings or pitches that we've observed. And, you know, it's tough because you can't always pick it up with your eye, which is where this technology comes in.
Jay, do you feel the work you're doing with Stephen and the U of M researchers, so this analytics thrust, is this research changing what people are seeing on the field from the Tigers?
You know, I certainly believe that this is having a positive impact on how we're progressing as an organization, and I think that can be seen here and throughout, quite honestly, baseball and sports as a whole. I think there's been quite a movement towards incorporating more analysis and data-driven research like this to improve on-field performance. So while you'll never know exactly why a player performs well, or how a player develops, you know, what is driving that, I certainly believe that this is 100% a positive impact on how players are going to perform.
Stephen, is this technology and what you're learning and the way you're doing the analytics, for example, working with the Tigers, can that be applied or is it being applied to other sports, other teams?
Yeah, certainly other sports, other teams, other applications, you know, the same types of technology can be applied to. So, you know, just in my own research, you know, I'm doing things, you know, looking at how military people are responding to using different equipment in different situations using this technology, to also trying to come up with different solutions in healthcare where now you can assess someone's health maybe through some wearable device, through the types of calculations that I'm doing. You know, they don't have to come in for a checkup to assess their frailty or their cardiovascular health. We can do that remotely. You know, maybe they just wear a sensor for a week. So based on the same type of technology and the same sort of techniques that we're applying here, but here, you know, the stakes are a little bit higher. And I think one of the key differences in the sports application is you have these experts, these coaches, you know, this whole buildup of people who have been thinking one way for, you know, their entire careers. And we're coming in with new information. And so really figuring out how the best way to pass that along to people that aren't Jay, How do you help them implement these new ideas, this new information into their kind of current workflow? So,
Jay, taking a baseball player from good to great is, I'm sure, a question that coaches and teams have been wrestling with since Major League Baseball began. Where do you see analytics taking baseball as you look to the future?
I think this is one of the areas that is in the forefront of where teams now are really focusing their efforts and understanding that there is now exists more technology and tools to help the game progress. And I think that there's has been a natural progression in baseball and all sports throughout the course of time as new tools come to light, whether that was the addition of the radar gun when that came into baseball to now the addition of StatCast or player tracking on the field or these player development type tools. I just see teams being able to utilize information to get smarter and make players get to their full capacity, perhaps in a more efficient manner than was done in the past. So I think in general that's a good thing for, you know, all the parties involved.
Jay Sartori, Senior Director of Baseball Analytics and Operations for the Detroit Tigers, and Stephen Kane, Assistant Research Scientist in Mechanical Engineering for the University of Michigan. Thanks to both of you for being with us on Stateside and sharing your work with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the internet is certainly a crucial tool in modern life, whether you're looking for a job or connecting with friends. But nearly half of Detroit households cannot afford to be online.
I would like to boil it down to just saying that people are digitally disenfranchised.
How Detroit's new Director of Digital Inclusion plans to change that. Stay tuned. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Think of all the reasons we go online, communicate with friends, take classes, apply for a job or for unemployment, and much, much more. As more organizations and government offices shift from in-person to online access, the people who don't have access to the internet are really left behind, and that would be around half of Detroit's households. Bridging that digital divide is why Joshua Edmonds has become Detroit's new Director of Digital Inclusion. Joshua, the FCC's defined high-speed internet as a public utility. It has made connecting American homes to the web a top priority. Why is it so many people in the city don't have a good way to get online?
Well, at the onset, and I, you know, when you were doing your introductory piece, you really hit on many of the nuances that I think a lot of people take for granted. Now, in terms of why people are struggling to get online, I think that we had to look at that and unpack that a little bit. It is looking at perpetual access. You have some people where maybe during tax refund season, they're able to essentially, you know, get online for a little bit. They have a little windstream of cash to be able to pay for an internet bill. However, when months get tough, the first bill that goes is the internet. And so what we're looking at and the measurement that you had touched on with the households, that is, you know, people who essentially are already struggling with, you know, keeping the lights on, getting water in the home. And if you had to choose between internet or water, I mean, 11 times out of 10, you're going to choose, you know, water. So I think that, you know, we have to look at the cost as a huge barrier. And this is, I don't blame my telecommunication companies. Some people in this role, in similar roles, will always, you know, go after the telecoms. And I think that it's, you know, up to us as a community to begin looking at a lot of the low-cost offerings and really make a communal push to educate residents and the stakeholders in the community on a lot of these low-cost options, because cost is such a barrier for the internet in today.
Yeah, cost is a barrier. And, you know, I know one option in some communities would be the public library, but because of financial troubles, the public libraries in Detroit, many of them have closed those branch libraries where you could maybe walk in and hop online.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I guess when you think about cost, what else? What else is that the main reason, or what are some of the other barricades?
Sure. So cost, yes, that is like the big one universally. However, there's three. So it always comes down to cost, relevance, and skill. Relevance is a huge barrier you're going to find, especially amongst your senior population, where they'll say, hey, look, I made it this far in life. I didn't need the internet then. I don't need it now. And I would say, you know, the internet's not a panacea. I don't want to force it or inundate anyone, you know, with it. But at the same time, you know, you have to educate them again to what you said in the beginning, all of those different services that are going online. If you are using any type of social service, the internet is relevant to you. And so making that case and showing the ways that it's relevant to you, that's been something that I've been very interested in doing, particularly with my seniors. And then again, that skill piece, I think that affects that's a whole spectrum-based approach where just a lot of people are saying, you know what, you guys are talking about this internet. Now I hear 5G and I don't even have, you know, internet in my home. What in the world? You know what? Forget it. I just don't know what people are doing. I'm just going to opt out.
Throw up your hands.
Absolutely. And so we're seeing a lot of that bundled together. And I would like to boil it down to just saying that people are digitally disenfranchised.
And here we're talking about seniors, but it's worth noting 70% of Detroit school children have no internet access at home. And boy, that sure can't help school performance.
Yes, absolutely. So we always talk about the homework gap. And you know, it's real. A lot of times people don't really understand some of the nuances associated with the homework gap. But when you take something, for example, like a research paper, it could be a 1 or 2 page paper on any topic, really. That paper might not necessarily have to be completed online. However, there's online components needed to actually do the research. And, you know, you brought up a great example with the libraries, because the counterpoint, someone would say, well, you can do the research at a library. Just go to a library. Well, yeah, if you live close, but mobility is a huge issue for many Detroiters. And so the library, I love them as an institution. I was raised on public libraries. I think that they are great. And thus far in my time in Detroit, they've been a great partner for me. But what I've been stressing to people is we need more players in this space. It can't just be a few institutions. This has to be a community thing. If you are a church and you're already doing this work, open up the doors and let people kind of come in and, you know, do their homework there. I mean, there's so many different ways that we can do this at a communal level.
And I think it's worth just taking a moment to do a great big shout out to the wonderful main branch of the Detroit Library right there in the Cultural Center on Woodward. It's fabulous, but it doesn't help you if you're living on the far east side of the city and transportation's an issue.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I guess when you think about unpacking things, talk a little more about how this is holding people back.
So I would say it's a number of ways. So, I mean, let's say, for example, let's look at a regular family. Regular family you can think of, you know, mom, dad in the house and kids.
Yeah.
We've seen, and this is coming from Ohio, Ohio's finding at the Ohio State University, they looked at broadband and like the value that broadband actually brings from an economic perspective. And they're saying that households on average, there's an $1,800 swing per household that's connected to broadband. And that $1,800 is not just, you know, just a regular cost. I mean, that's more so like these houses with broadband tend to be able to access jobs faster. So if you're looking for a job, it's kind of a no-brainer that it's like, oh, well, you know, you got the internet. That's kind of where they're being advertised at this point. And even past that, there's a familiarity component with that too, where if I'm looking for jobs online, I must have some type of online familiarity or at least some type of technical familiarity or savviness. And so if people who are already struggling to use the computer to look for a job, then what actually happens when they actually get into the job? I mean, it could be, we're not even talking about coding at this point. We're talking about just really basic data processing that could be very intimidating for many people. So it's like, okay, from the workforce development standpoint, this is a critical need. When Amazon HQ2 was happening and it was the craze, oh, where are they going to relocate? One of the things Amazon had said was, we want to find a place that has a strong tech workforce, a strong tech ecosystem. That was what they looked for. And if we're talking about, you know, this huge population of households that aren't connected to the internet, can you really justify saying that you have a strong one? That's just not really likely. So, I mean, that's literally one angle. The other angle that, you know, I've been telling people, and this is a great way for banks to get involved, because we know there's a Community Reinvestment Act, and at least I haven't seen it here. Maybe some people have been able to do it, but you can leverage Community Reinvestment Act dollars for broadband investment. And the whole push on this one, where the banks kind of play a role, because if we have online banking being a thing, then in order for people to take advantage of that, you know, it goes back to the internet. So it's like from one end, you know, I'm talking about workforce. Another end, you hear me talking about banking. We've already done the, you know, K-12 homework gap example. And that one you can honestly continuously unpack, because I have two incredible interns I was able to hire last week. One of them's at University of Michigan. The other one's at University of Chicago. And they're with me. Well, they're not in the studio right now, but they're with me at the city. And both of them told me when they went in for their freshman year in college, both of them did not know how to type.
Wow.
And so it's like things like this. They are getting into incredible institutions, and they don't even know how to, you know, do a very, very basic thing like typing. And so it's like, what future are we sending our kids off into or to embark on? It's just one that's very, very uncertain, and I don't think it has to be. And so, again, we can continuously unpack and go into so many different levels, but, I mean, it's honestly endless. And for me, I have not ruled out a single person as a stakeholder in Detroit. I have said it. If you are a resident in Detroit, if you are a business in Detroit of any type, you are a stakeholder to me. Because, I mean, it's as ubiquitous as the internet is, that's kind of how my effort I want it to be as well.
If you just joined us, I'm talking with Joshua Edmonds, who's Detroit's new Director of Digital Inclusion. You know, Joshua, here we're talking about lack of access to the internet in urban areas like Detroit, but we hear a lot about that also in many rural areas. I mean, what's going on here? Are there similarities?
Yes, yes. So there are clear similarities, and there are differences too. You know, the rural places, they might have one provider. In urban cities, we really don't have the same internet access issue, per se, as your rural places. We have a lot of broadband assets that are available. It's just that people can't afford to take advantage of those. So, I mean, the access, you'll see it. It's just people aren't really subscribing it to it based on those barriers to internet adoption we touched on earlier.
Right.
However, for the rural people, they're like, look, we legitimately don't have the infrastructure in place. And if we do, it's really, really spotty. And it's, you know, what you're paying for in some of these cases is not even, you're not even getting broadband at this point. You're getting, you know, just basic internet, but it's incredibly expensive. Those are two separate issues. But what I do believe there's a great opportunity to have a discussion between, you know, rural and urban is that for urban folks, it's, we already have the internet service providers here. We can't afford it. So for the rural people, it's like, okay, once we get them here, affordability will be a concern. How is urban taking care of that right now? So I think it's a really great opportunity to work together there. It just doesn't happen enough.
And the end result, the end impact on people's lives is the same, urban and rural.
Absolutely.
So as Director of Digital Inclusion, how are you going to be able to close this digital divide in Detroit? What are you doing to close the gap?
At the moment, I'm doing things like this.
I mean, getting out there. I know you're newly appointed. You're getting into the ropes here.
Absolutely. You know, I have a strategy that I believe would definitely work. But, you know, and this is kind of just from years of studying in this field and implementing a few successful projects myself in when I was in Cleveland.
Yeah. In fact, we should mention to everybody, you were doing digital inclusion work in Cleveland. So,
yes.
Yeah, what lessons did you learn there that you're going to bring to Detroit?
Oh, man. I mean, where do I start? I would say at the very beginning, community equity matters. That has been a core belief of mine. It doesn't matter how great your strategy is. If you're not able to get the buy-in from the stakeholders you need and the user group you need, it's not really useful. And what I mean by that, the core stakeholders, at least I should say the residents, it's the residents 200% or below at the poverty level. These are people who are facing widespread housing insecurity, who will move, you know, 4 to 5 times a year, people who, you know, are very reliant on social services. I need to get those people, that pool of residents, because when we're looking at that huge percentage of people not adopting the internet, that's the population right there that I need. And so for me, it's like I could have a foolproof strategy, but if I'm not in the community building that equity, building relationships with community stakeholders who are already doing this work, then, you know, my strategy doesn't work. And so in Cleveland, you know, we were very fortunate when I was working at the Cleveland Foundation. Cleveland Foundation, you know, being one of the largest foundations in America, we were able to essentially capitalize on that community equity. And the investments we did were, you know, we did a few, but it was because we had that equity already built up. So right now I've just been on a listening tour, hearing out people's concerns. I don't want to be invasive with any of my technology, but rather be much more integrative in the way that we can use technology to integrate into existing social networks that people have been able to build with community-facing organizations.
But the big thing is cost. So you're going to need money. Who's going to give you money?
Absolutely. Everybody.
Well, love your optimism.
Well, no, I mean, honestly, yes, while cost is definitely an issue, I'm not really looking to look at like public dollars, like how let's get a tax increase to do this. Mm-hmm. I'm not looking to do that. I'm looking to be as lean and as effective as possible. You know, obviously everyone mentions the foundations here, but you know, there's certain elements of the strategy that I'm kind of pushing for. For example, I'll give away one of the things.
All right.
give it all, but one of them. You know, the other day I was meeting with a nonprofit in the community on the east side, and I was saying that, you know, one of the big things that people take advantage of at the libraries are the library's Wi-Fi. You know, people will literally just go into the parking lot, sit there, and connect to their Wi-Fi. It's already been programmed in many of the people's brains in the community collectively that libraries have Wi-Fi. And so I said, you know, libraries aren't the only entities that have Wi-Fi, but yet, you know, everyone's kind of going to them. So I said, what way can I, for example, talk to nonprofits and say, hey, do you guys have Wi-Fi on site? People are using it. Why can't we kind of publicize that? Why can't we let them know that there are free networks all around us? I mean, I think that everyone's really looking for the city of Detroit to come in and create a Detroit-wide Wi-Fi network. Sadly, I don't believe that we have the assets to do so. That's millions and millions and millions of dollars, especially for the city the size of Detroit. However, when we look at all of these faith-based organizations, you look at all of these nonprofits, you look at all these different entities that already have free Wi-Fi on the site. And so for me, we're like, this is a really easy lift. Can't we just find a way where we can empower residents with decision-making to say that if, you know, aside from you catching that bus to go 45 minutes to your nearest library, what about that church on the corner that has Wi-Fi? What about that, you know, nonprofit over here? I mean, it's thinking like that, and that's a community-driven way, and that's not a whole lot of money to do that, if any. That's just more so us just saying we have a service that we didn't know that we could publicize.
And there you go. You could create homework spaces and workspaces.
Absolutely.
For people. What would success look like to you? What do you want Detroit's digital access picture to look like in 5 years?
Oh, yes. I love this. So 5 years from now, I no longer want us to be up. So let me backtrack. Of cities of 100,000 residents or more, Detroit is the least connected city in America. I don't even want to be in the bottom 10 of that anymore. And I honestly believe with the plan that, you know, we're putting in place and the equity that we're building up right now, realistically, we won't be in the bottom 10 anymore. I'm being bold in this one. I really am. But that's us being out of that bottom 10. And that is us illuminating pathways and providing residents the options to be able to choose to, if I want to be, for example, if I want to be a software developer, what is the exact residential pathway that I can take? Don't point me to, you know, some really, really expensive boot camp. Don't point me, what community assets can I take advantage of? And that's empowering people at so many different levels. That approach goes across the board. If I want to connect to this or that, you know, what does that look like? Can we get a connected Detroit where every single entity or organization recognizes there's a divide and they're doing things such as nominal as to what you pointed out. Hey, we have homework centers here. We have an extra room. We're going to be here from 5 to 7:30 already. You guys want to come in here to use our Wi-Fi, use our computer labs. I mean, it's literally, I think, to see an integrated Detroit where we are collectively working together and no one entity is owning this entire process.
And you're, I'm sure, going to be building models that other areas that are on the wrong side of the digital divide can learn from.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, it's really, really interesting because I've been looking for just the non-typical partners, people that are like, why are you partnering with them? And to give you an example, I spoke to recently Gleaners, the, you know, food distribution network. And I was talking to them. I'm like, wow, you guys might think that this is crazy. I'm reaching out to you, but just hear me out. You guys are serving organizations that serve the people who are struggling or have some type of food insecurity. I said, you know, Amazon has figured this out. If I buy a phone, they'll say, might you need a case? So what would happen then if we got so smart and said, we notice you're struggling to pay for food. Might you be struggling to pay for technology as well? And how do we empower people to take advantage of the offerings that we can provide? I think that's the way that I would love to see that happen.
Joshua Edmonds is Detroit's new Director of Digital Inclusion. And please come back and keep us posted on the work you're doing. It would be great to talk with you again and follow the progress.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Tomorrow on Stateside, the Maureen Choi Quartet is making international waves with their flamenco and jazz-inspired classical music that some call Spanish chamber jazz.
Well, I've always been interested in Spain in a way because the music has just always drawn me to that place. The only word that comes to mind when I describe Spanish music is that it's just handsome. It's not only beautiful, it's just handsome.
That is tomorrow on Stateside. And that's our program for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.